A vegan turned hunter makes the case for mindful eating. By the time he was 20, Tovar Cerulli was a committed vegan. But when he turned 30, health issues prompted him to add more protein in the form of eggs and meat to his diet. He decided he'd hunt the meat that ended up on his dinner plate. In his book, The Mindful Carnivore, Cerulli makes a case for the importance of understanding the impact that our food and the means by which it's produced has upon the planet and on all living things. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll talk with Cerulli about his philosophy of food, which he says has actually been well received by many vegetarians. Join the conversation. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, message the Maine Calling Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. A vegetarian's search for sustenance. This is Maine Calling. Tovar Cerulli, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
You're described as a vegan turned hunter, which on the face would seem like a fairly major transformation. But you would say that there are commonalities between those two camps. Explain kind of how you bridge what would otherwise seem like a fairly significant distance.
Sure. You know, I've found both in my own journey and also in talking with people in person, exchanging conversations, comments online, and in discussions around my book, that a lot of folks across the dietary spectrum, whatever they eat and however they get it, care about knowing where their food comes from, care about not having gratuitous impacts on the natural world or on animals. So some of these basic values that we might not think are carried across that kind of spectrum seem to be.
Let's go back to the foundations of your vegetarianism, which begin in childhood in Vermont.
You know, I was, like most kids, I was an omnivore. I ate what was put in front of me and happily so, and did a lot of fishing as a kid. It was in my late teens and early and when I was 20 that the shift to vegetarianism really happened.
You experimented with vegetarianism in high school.
I started to have contact with the diet and you say, this is good food. I like this too. And then the shift was really an ethical, moral, and then an ecological shift for me.
So by the age of 20, you're a fully committed vegan. Explain for the uninitiated what the difference between vegan and vegetarian.
Sure. You know, a vegetarian diet simply means that you don't eat any meat, any flesh foods. So generally for vegetarians, you know, any red meat, fish, chicken, all off the table, so to speak. And vegans also exclude anything that comes from animals. So dairy products, eggs, and in for many, honey as well comes from small animals, but bees.
Would that extend to, you know, for example, wearing leather shoes?
It does generally, yeah. It extends to excluding any materials that you can that come from animals.
By the age of 30, though, you discover some health issues, which you attribute to deficiencies in your diet.
Yeah, I'd been vegan for 10 years at that point, and both my doctor, who was a not a mainstream doctor by any means, it was a Buddhist naturopath, and yet she said, you know, based on some analysis of your blood chemistry, maybe you should think about something a bit different in your diet. And my wife was also studying nutrition at the time and made some similar suggestions. I wasn't direly ill, but those changes helped my energy level, my immune system, and so on.
Can you describe sort of what they were and specifically what the deficiencies were and what it was causing?
You know, I'm not a nutritional expert, but I imagine that it was a combination of, you know, B12 is a common issue in the long term for vegans, vitamin B12. There are some fatty acids that are hard to get. So for me, it was low energy, a depressed immune system. I got colds fairly often. My allergies were active, that sort of thing.
So there were ways other than simply turning to meat to to offset those deficiencies, right? But you opted for meat or for eggs at first?
Yeah, it was gradual. You know, it was fairly radical for us at the time to have a bowl of yogurt, you know. It was a big change. So we did that. We had added some yogurt. My wife and I added that to our diet, some eggs. So it was gradual. And then it was just some local, you know, some local chicken and a bit of fish. It was a gradual change.
Explain the experience, though, of those, you know, those first times when after a long period of time of living on vegetables and experiencing the consumption of a meat product.
It was very strange. During my vegetarian years, during my vegan years, I recall having something that was like the texture of meat once at a vegetarian restaurant. It was a good imitation, and it was very strange, even that. And actually returning to eating something like yogurt and eggs and then an actual flesh food was very disconcerting in many ways.
Also, I guess you had to, there were moral questions that you were raising with yourself and trying to sort through philosophical questions. Talk a little bit about that transformation.
That started a few years before my diet changed, actually, when I realized that agriculture has all kinds of impacts on the natural world and on animals, whether it's grain combines going through an industrially farmed field and chopping up all kinds of creatures as it goes, or even just a couple of miles down the road at the local organic farm where my wife and I would buy strawberries and greens. You know, woodchucks are getting smoke bombed, deer are getting shot in that field so we can get our, you know, organic fruit and salad. And that was a rude awakening for me to recognize that. And it softened the edges of my ethics. It softened the edges of my rigid notions about food well before I actually changed my diet.
So rather than saying, well, maybe killing animals directly isn't so bad, you were looking at sort of the negative impacts that even vegetable farming has, for animal contents in fertilizers, and even sort of larger scale questions about the impacts on the environment that moving large truckloads of foods from Iowa to Maine might have on the ecosystem.
That's right. And even to create a large farm field to grow a lot of vegetables or grain or soybeans, you know, you're taking prairie habitat or forest habitat and so-called converting it. You're wiping it out and turning it into what often is more of a monoculture.
Central to this book is this idea that that rather than be so focused on the kind of food you're eating, to be mindful just of where it comes from, its true costs, and to be aware of that, not in a way that kind of overburdens your brain every day, but to just be aware. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. That notion of how complex those relationships are among where we get our food and how it gets produced. And just an awareness of that. A great part of that for me and for many people, I think, is a sense of gratitude and indebtedness to the natural world and a desire to minimize those impacts, not to have them be gratuitous, but recognize that a sense of escape or innocence is out of reach. We can't get away from that.
Join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You turn to hunting. You decide that, in addition to just eating meat, though, you're going to play an active part in it and witness directly that sort of natural thing that happens when an animal dies. Why did you think that was important?
When we made that shift to eating a bit of chicken and fish in our diet, we actually weren't even eating any red meat. I went back to fishing at that point and wanted to have a direct hand in that. The idea of hunting crept in, and it did creep in because I was resistant to the notion, as a way to confront that. That was one of the major reasons to confront the fact that whether it was down the road at the local organic farm where they were shooting deer occasionally or in other forms of food production, that I was having a direct impact, and now I was eating other creatures. So that confrontation was a significant part of that choice.
And while many vegetarians would agree with you that it's important to be aware of the impacts that your food has, I'm sure they're still listening, and we'll maybe hear from some of them today, who would say, look, we don't need to eat meat to survive, and therefore we don't need to kill animals, and they're, and it's just plain wrong.
Mm-hmm.
How does that conversation go now after you've written this book?
Well, from the people who have actually read the book, including vegetarians, have by and large been very positive in their response. I've had a few negative reactions from people who haven't, who hear a very simple boiled down version of it or just read the cover and judge it. But broadly, I think that, you know, for me, the conversation goes, you know, well, to some degree, our impacts are inevitable, and I think the human species needs some animal foods, not necessarily meat, but we do need some animal foods as a species. We also need fertilizers. If we're not using petroleum, we need animal fertilizers for small-scale sustainable agriculture. Our impacts are there, and we can choose to engage with them in various ways personally, but they are inescapable at some level.
And you explain how, you know, the hunt is an important part for you of being connected to that process. But it's not really practical for all of us to go hunting. There aren't enough licenses to go around, and Maine would be a scary place if everybody got to hunt for their meat. What do the rest of us do who have to just go to the grocery store, for example? How do we do that and still achieve the level of awareness and respect that you enjoy?
You know, I think hunting is one very specific practice, and as you suggest, there are, you know, lots of other people who can do lots of other things. Just knowing something about where our food comes from, whether it's knowing local farms, having connection with a local farmer's market, even just educating ourselves a little bit about where our food comes from, gardening a little bit helps, just feeling connected and knowing something about where at least some of our food comes from.
This is Maine Calling on listener-supported MPBN Radio. We want to hear from you. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Today is a special day. We want to hear from you in another way as well. We're going to take a quick break now and check in on our Super Thursday one-day membership campaign. It's your chance to support programs like Maine Calling. Please do your part and do it today, right now. Our one-day campaign is designed to raise the critical listener support as efficiently as possible, as quickly as possible in just one day. So won't you do your part right now? Call 1-800-884-1717. And now here's Charles Beck with a bit more information. And welcome back to Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Thank you for doing your part for listener-supported public radio. Every call counts. Let's make Super Thursday a success. That number again, 1-800-866-1475. Today we're speaking with Tovar Cerulli. He's the author of The Carnivore's Dilemma, A Vegetarian's Hunt for Sustenance. Join our conversation. Call, it's not The Carnivore's Dilemma. We'll get to the book in a second. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Talk at mpbn.net. It's the email address. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Tovar, the correct name of the book?
The Mindful Carnivore.
Mindful Carnivore. Sorry about that. Before the break, we were talking about hunting and the process of taking an active role in this. And, you know, here in Maine, hunting has been a tradition for generations. And many of those hunters feel connected to that source of meat. They also love being in the woods and feel connected to the outdoors. So in a sense, that part of it is not a new thing. That's sort of a it's a New England thing that's been happening for years. Is that something that you've found as well?
That I found that?
That in terms of hunters, traditional hunters, who felt connected to their food.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that that's a big part of a lot of traditional hunting culture in Maine, in Vermont, in New Hampshire, and other places in the country and the world. You know, people hunt for lots of different reasons, and there's lots of different layers of meaning that it has for them, and that varies from hunter to hunter and from place to place. But that sense of connection to the land and connection to a certain part of their food source is certainly important.
If you'd like to join the conversation, do so. It's 1-800-366-399-3566. The number, a lot of numbers flying around today. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Maybe you're a vegan. Maybe you're a hunter. Maybe you have comments about knowing where your food is coming from. Join the conversation here today. You also talk about in the book or acknowledge the benefits of hunting for the ecosystem. For example, keeping the deer population in check. Is that another consideration in the larger scheme?
In a broad sense, it is. It's something that a lot of hunters invoke when we talk about hunting. I think very few hunters are primarily motivated to go out there and be responsible wildlife managers. You know, they're not hunting deer for mainly that reason. But it is, particularly here in the East and parts of the Midwest, you know, controlling deer populations with a lack of other large predators on the landscape is important for ecosystems and for the viability of agriculture as well.
I'm wondering, I heard recently about efforts in some places to convince Westerners to consider insects as a source of protein, provided they can get beyond, you know, the barriers that I think are all there. Have you explored that?
I mean, I have not. I have not gone after insects. Cultural prejudice, I'm sure.
Yeah. But some would argue a good source of protein and possibly, you know, sustainable. But who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe one of our listeners does know. Let's take a call. And Roger, who is in the car. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, this is Dr. Roger Nato. Can you hear me okay? I'm in the backcountry of Route 11.
Sure, yes. We've got you now, so go quickly before you disappear.
Yeah. Well, I have a question and a comment. My question is, I do nutrition in my work, and my question is, prior to turning vegan with concerns of energy and the immune system, I wondered if the author, and I'm sorry I can't remember his name, but was doing any refined sugars and refined flours. And number two, if he had done any investigation into staying vegan and just eating really correctly to be able to get the proper amino acids and protein in his diet from nuts and seeds and essential oils, things like that.
Yeah, Roger, you're sort of fading in and out, so we'll let you go, but we'll let Tovar answer those two questions.
So in terms of refined sugar and flours, we were eating very little of that, you know, that kind of food in our diet. We were taking some supplements in addition to, you know, to our regular food. You know, at that point, given what I understood about some of the other impacts that my diet was having, and the fact that we were, you know, using cow and chicken manure to fertilize our own garden and things like that, I didn't feel that sticking to my guns as a vegan and really staying entrenched in that diet was as relevant as I had once thought it was. That sense of, you know, rigid certainty that eating plants was the right thing and that eating anything else was wrong, I had let go of that at that point. So I was more open. And so adding those other foods into my diet seemed like, you know, a reasonable thing to try. without, you know, exploring every last possible option for remaining vegan.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And let's see. We have a listener asking that, or noting that he had heard that the Dalai Lama considers eating vegetables as taking life. And he says, we'll eat one yak for a whole year. And I think you comment about Tibetan monks, this curious philosophy or belief system about meat. Can you sort of explain? They can't seek out meat, but are not forbidden from eating it either.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that the Dalai Lama writes about in his autobiography. He was vegetarian briefly and then returned to eating meat. In his personal diet. And he comments in his autobiography on Tibetan Buddhism and how in the 1960s, at least, meat was a fairly common food. It was a staple of the local diet in Tibet. And that, as you say, Tibetan Buddhists could eat it. And Buddhism, according to the Dalai Lama, does not forbid the eating of meat, but they weren't allowed to order it. They weren't allowed to go and say, please, you know, please get some meat for me, because then someone might go kill an animal for them. It's this weird sort of contorted gymnastic logic, and he calls it Tibetans' rather curious attitude toward meat. That's what the Dalai Lama calls
yeah.
it.
So in fact, they would do what many of us do, which is just allow somebody else to kill it first.
That's right. And the Dalai Lama says that in the Tibetan case, at least then in the 1960s, that local Muslims ended up doing that job because the local Buddhists couldn't do it.
You say in the book also that at first you and your wife did have some concerns about seafood and shellfish because of what we all have heard about in terms of contaminants that make their way into fish in particular.
Sure, contaminants and also you know unsustainable over-harvesting and the overfishing of the oceans is a substantial problem as well. And our freshwater fish, unfortunately, here we have mercury contamination and so on. I think those fears are sometimes a little bit over exaggerated, but they are something to be aware of, especially for children and pregnant mothers.
Let's go to Wakefield and John. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks. Well, Tovar just mentioned what I wanted to point out, which is the Maine Center for Disease Control does have an advisory which basically says if you are a woman who's pregnant or nursing or could be, no fish. And that's wild caught in Maine. And if you're an adult or you're a kid over 8, you can eat one fish per month that you catch in the wild. So Topher says that may be a little bit exaggerated, but I think it's still pretty alarming. And I'm an avid fisherman and hunter, so I just thought that'd be important to point out. What's going on in the Midwest with coal-fired plants is affecting us here in Maine.
Yeah, it's true. Certainly, even the most, what look like the most pristine ponds up in, the North Country, there's contamination there.
Yeah. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We're here with Tovar Cerulli. He is the author of The Mindful Carnivore. And we're going to take another short break here. It's Super Thursday here at MPBN. We need your help, your financial support, in bringing you interesting, informative programs like those you've heard on Maine Calling, as well as all the other public affairs and cultural and music shows that this station, MPBN, brings every day. Show your support now. Call 1-800-866-1475. Continue to keep MPBN strong, vibrant, where you want it, on the radio, online, wherever, whenever you want it. Let's all work together to make this one-day Super Thursday concept a working reality. And here's Charles Beck. And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. And thank you if you've just called or called earlier this morning or are already a supporting member. Your support makes a difference in keeping MPBN Radio, Maine Calling, and all the other programs loud and clear here. And that number again, 1-800-866-1475. Thank you. Today on the program, From Vegan to Hunter, join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. Tovar Cerulli is the author of The Mindful Carnivore, A Vegetarian's Hunt for Sustenance. To Brewer now, and Chris. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you. Go ahead, please.
Oh, yeah. So when I was younger, I used to work for a Seventh-day Adventist couple, and they follow a pretty strict vegetarian, vegan diet. And what I wanted to share was the woman I worked for, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was recommended, chemo, radiation, traditional treatments. But instead, she went on a raw food diet for weeks, and tumors went away. All of the signs of the cancers were treated, and she also maintained a vegan diet afterwards and had no signs of the cancer coming back. I mean, I was just wondering if you've heard of any more cases of life-threatening illnesses being treated by purely diet, and why it isn't more publicized if that's the case, and why we're using dangerous chemicals instead of natural food.
Yeah. Tovar, do you go, in your writing and in your work and research, do you go much into this, the sort of the larger health questions about diet?
I don't. I mean, I don't focus a lot on nutrition. What Chris mentions, I've heard similar stories, about people changing their diets. And I think that a healthy diet that gets rid of a lot of the sugars and heavy chemicals and so on that are in our processed foods is really important and can be part of major health turnarounds. But it's not something that I focus on.
What were your first experiences hunting? There was a lot going on in your mind.
Sure. I still had a lot of ambivalence about the idea of hunting. It took me a while to settle into it. And given that I was fairly clueless as a hunter, I had one uncle in my family I could learn from, but I didn't know much. I spent a lot of time in the woods being quiet. that was true for the first few years.
And when you were successful and you saw the animal fall, what was going through your mind?
The first time I took a deer, which was my fourth year as a hunter, it was a really deeply shocking experience for me. And I was in a state of shock, and underneath that was a lot of sadness, a lot of grief. And I doubted that I would ever do it again. I really was not sure.
Did you do a lot of sort of soul searching at that moment?
I was sort of in that emotional and shock experience. Over the next couple of days, I did a lot of soul searching. And it was those couple of days during which I was actually doing the butchering myself, doing all that. That was sort of my soul searching time to come to terms with it and decide if I would ever do it again.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. To Palmyra and Peggy. Hi, Peggy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to point out that vegetarianism is unknown in traditional cultures. There are no traditional cultures that have ever been found to be vegetarian. We evolved as meat eaters. We evolved as omnivores. But we did not evolve eating grain. Grain is a relatively recent introduction to our diet. We've been evolving for 7 or 8 million years. We've been grain eaters for less than 10,000 years. And consequently, we're seeing a huge rise in gluten intolerance. This is not a fad. There has been, over the last 50 years, a 400% increase in the gluten content of wheat. They've been hybridizing wheat. 400% increase. Coincidentally, in the last 50 years, there has been 400 times increase in the occurrence of celiac disease. So for those who are noticing that they're gluten intolerant, there's a reason for that. And I think it's important to be aware of that.
Peggy, thanks for calling, Tovar.
Yeah, I mean, certainly our diet has changed a lot in the past, few decades, in the past couple hundred years, and also, as Peggy points out, in the past, 10 millennia. It has changed a lot, and maybe our bodies have not adapted. I think that a vegetarian diet that includes some dairy, some eggs, much like early American vegetarianism in the 1800s, much like what's been going on in India for much longer and other parts of the world, I think a lot of people do fairly well on that. The strict vegan diet is a more recent experiment in human diet, and I have some questions about that for its longevity.
We're also talking, though, about the quality of meat. For example, when you're eating thin strips of deer, that lean deer that you have shot, that's not the same as eating, you know, the crackling of a pig that was, you know, mass produced in Iowa.
Absolutely. And, you know, my wife and I don't eat that much meat at all. You know, we get some local chicken still, and if I get lucky in a given year, we have some venison. But having a small portion of very lean wild meat is entirely different from having, whether it's, you know, pork or beef that has been, you know, pumped full of antibiotics and who knows what else. Yeah, they're very different qualities.
We've also seen health threats from vegetables, which have occurred because of contamination. And usually these are linked to the sort of the risks that are associated with trying to produce vast amounts of it for a large market.
Yeah. And, you know, I did my master's thesis research recently and interviewed a couple dozen people, including here in Maine and elsewhere in New England and elsewhere in the country, people who came to hunting as adults. And quite a few of them expressed real discomfort with the industrial food system and that kind of mass production and concerns about its safety. They were also organic gardeners. They were also doing they were being involved in their own food production in a variety of ways. And part of it was a discomfort and distrust with that system.
1-800-399-3566 to Brunswick and Biff. Hi, Biff.
Yeah, hi. No real question, more of a comment, just that I, too, was once a vegetarian, although I was never a vegan. But for many years, vegetarian, and slowly my wife and I have gotten back into eating meat. And 3 years ago, decided to go duck hunting. We have a camp back on a river, and it's called Duck Camp. So we figured, what the heck? We might as well face the consequences of where these animals are coming from. And it's just been a really interesting coming from this liberal anti-gun background to now be into hunting ducks and very much enjoying it. But of interest is liberal friends and their reactions and getting into an occasional argument, being called a murderer.
Yeah, sorry, Biff. We're sort of running out of time here. I do want to mention that you're at Longfellow Books tonight, Tovar?
That's right. I'll be at Longfellow Books here in Portland at 7 p.m. for a discussion and book signing.
And the book is The Mindful Carnivore. And just quickly, you said it's been well received, except by those who sort of saw the title and didn't read it. Just talk a little bit about how it's been received. Do they agree with you that it's okay to eat meat if you so believe, or are they saying that your message about being mindful of where your food comes from is valid?
You know, a number of vegetarians who have read the book have been, you know, very open to it, have said that it's, you know, very thought-provoking, and have been aware and have said that they understand that the book is not some kind of omnivore's manifesto or some kind of hunter's manifesto trying to convince everyone to go that direction, but rather asking people to look at some things from some other perspectives and make their own choices. And they've really respected that.
Tovar Cerulli, thanks so much for being here. Tovar Cerulli is the author of The Mindful Carnivore, A Vegetarian's Hunt for Sustenance. He'll be at Longfellow Books tonight at 7 p.m. Today's program produced by our volunteers Scott McAuliffe and Jonathan Smith. Volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board. We had additional help from the MPBN web team, and you can listen to this conversation and previous editions of the show by visiting mpbn.net. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. And you've been listening to Super Thursday as well. We all work here together collaboratively to make this public broadcasting service possible. If you value this, please join me and others around the state in making it possible. Here's the number to call, 1-800-866-1475. Thank you, and now here's Charles Beck.